It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Good afternoon, Fairbanks. This is Randy Zarnke, your host for another episode of Alaska Tracks. Each Saturday, we listen to an interview that I recorded years ago with a veteran outdoorsman. It might be a big game guide or a wildlife biologist or a trapper. They share stories from throughout their long careers. Hopefully, you find these stories both educational and entertaining. Today's special guest is Sam Snyder. Sam grew up in Washington State. He moved to Alaska as a young man when given the opportunity to manage a wilderness lodge. Sam made the most of that time. He hunted and fished and trapped in a remote area of the southeast mainland. He subsequently went on to become a big game guide, a fish and game technician, and a receiving agent for a world-renowned taxidermy outfit. Let's dive into this first section of Sam's interview, in which Snyder tells us about his youth in Washington and Montana. Towards the end, he also shares a little bit about moving to Alaska.
I came from a family of loggers and small ranchers in western Washington. Everybody in the family hunted, and my brother was quite a trapper. We had a pretty good-sized place. Dad had 240 acres there in western Washington, south of Tacoma. We had cattle, chickens, and whatever all farmers and ranchers had. We had coyote problems, so we had the state trapper come out. His name was Frank Hansler. Came out and set some coyote traps, and I went around with him on my saddle horse. He asked me to check the traps. I was about 12 years old, so you know, that was a big, exciting thing. And it was a crude type of set that he used, big old dug fir stump for the background, more or less, and he'd set two number three traps about 18 inches apart and had a dead chicken, drove a stake in the ground, the base of the stump, and he'd wire it in there. Used a piece of paper for the pan cover, and I think he made three sets, and I'd ride my saddle horse out there. I'd check them two or three times a week. But boy, I was all excited. And then Frank said, well, why don't you just go ahead and do it? There was a $5 bounty on coyotes there at that time, and so one thing led to another. And so I'd catch a coyote now and then just by using that same method. Then I kept thinking I could make more money if I set more traps. Washington Farmer, there was an ad that a guy over in Bremerton, his name was Fred Tyee, he was an Indian, and he'd teach you all the methods of trapping coyote. For I think it was $50. So I got with my ma, and she loaned me the money, and so I sent off for this package. And it was probably one of the better $50 I ever spent in my life. The methods that he had in there, most of it was all by just using scent and how to make scents. Mainly use a male dog with you when you were making your sets. And by this time, I was 15 years old, and I had hounds, because my dad used to have hounds. Since Frank Hansler was quite a hound man, and he'd taken several cougar and always run bobcats and bear and etc. And so I ended up in the hound business, and of course, Dad went along with it. So one thing kind of led to another, and I got to where I could catch coyotes pretty good. The most popular scent was just liver. I still make it to this day for guys. Start out with beef liver and then use coyote liver, and it takes quite a bit of time to break the darn thing down and start making a good scent. And anal glands and the gallbladder off the liver. For a base, rather than using glycerin like they used to use, I use seal oil. I was just having a lot of fun catching a lot of coyotes, and like I say, there was a $5 bounty, so I was making a couple of dollars now and then. And I got acquainted with some of the fish and game people in the state of Washington, and that was back, oh gosh, about 1951. 51, 52, I started doing some work with the state game department, planting fish into High Mountain Lake, which was another big kick. It was just so much fun doing that, and we had 7.5 gallon pack cans on a frame that you usually carry about 1,500, 2,000 fish. We even put beaver into some of the high mountain areas to make beaver ponds. Of course, the timber companies liked it for fire protection. And I worked then as a deputy game protector for the state. Of course, we all kept up with our deer hunting, all the woods work, you know, and got to know where all the good deer hunting was, get big bucks. And I'd made a trip to Montana in off seasons. out working on a cattle ranch. Well, then everybody was telling me about all the lion tracks they were seeing, which was mountain lion or cougar. Boy, I had never got a cougar, and I thought, boy, that'd be great. I was only making $200 a month working on the cattle ranch there, and I decided to quit the job and go cattle hunting. I only had one old hound. My father-in-law, he lived on a ranch, and they had a place for the wife and I and our only child we had at that time. And so we went over and stayed there. And so Old Smoke and I, that's my old dog's name, went up to one of the summer cow camps. Jeez, I was up there 2 days, and I got about a 7-foot male cat. Man, I thought that was great. The little camp we had there, it was a little old trailer house, and Smoke and I rode up this canyon one morning, and I cut this track, and I was looking at the big bull elk, and I thought, boy, that'd be nice if the season was open. And anyway, then we cut this cat track, and Smoke got interested and got to work in it. And pretty soon here we come right up on a fresh kill. He'd killed his 4-point mule deer, and he'd eaten a good portion of the hind quarters, and then, of course, he had everything all covered up. He had pulled a bunch of twigs and branches over it. So we got to looking around there, and he worked it out where the cat had went, and made a couple circles, and he took off and barked a couple times, and pretty soon I heard him barking tree. So I went in there, and there was a little ledge running into this little bunch of timber. But I looked and looked, and the dog barked. I didn't see no cat, and so I tied my horse up, and I took my rifle. I had a .32 Special. Went up on top of this little rim. There was about, 2-3 inches of snow. And I was standing there, and the dog would bark and bark and bark. And I kept looking, and all of a sudden, not more than 20 feet from me, right even with me, here's this big tom laying on these branches in this tree, looking right straight at me. Man, you talk about a case of buck fever. Man, my heart was really pumping. So I leaned up against a tree, and I'm only shooting 20 feet or so, and I shot this cat. My horse was only about 30 feet from where this damn cat fell. By that time, Old Smoke was down there. Well, I had my first cougar, and I had a problem with the horse. The horse didn't want no part of that cat. So I ended up tying a rope around his neck, tied that around the cat's neck, and drug it back down to an old wagon trail and we could get a Jeep into. So I gutted him out and cleaned because I knew that they were good eating. I rode all the way back out to the ranch that night and called a neighbor that had a Jeep. And so he and I went up the next morning and drug this cat out. And of course, I was kind of the hero of the ranchers around there because nobody around there had been taking any cats. So I spent about 2 days at the ranch, and I went back up, and in 2 days I killed 3 more.
You were on a hot streak.
Oh, I was. That was the end of the cougar that I was able to get though that winter. But I got a number of bobcat. I think I had those 4 cougar, and I got about 10 or 12 bobcat. Some of the ranchers were having trouble with the bobcats chasing their chickens, and so they'd call me. And
now the bobcats, you get those trapping?
No, I got them with the dog. All that hunting there in Montana was done with hounds. So I then went back over to the coast. The woods opened up in the spring, and so I went back to logging again and finally got into working with the Department of Fish and Game there in Washington. And one of the game protectors told me that there was an opening for a predator control agent with the Fish and Wildlife Service and thought I ought to apply for the job, which I did. I was working in the woods. It was in October. And I came home from work one evening, and here's this car with a federal license plate on. I thought, geez, what did I do wrong? I went in the house, and here is Milton Webster, which was a supervisor in Seattle for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He introduced himself. He stayed for dinner that night with us. Everything was fine. He said, you got the job. That was in 1956. Well, I had a few traps. He said, don't worry about your traps. Said, we furnish all that stuff. So I was in September when I got the job, so I couldn't wait, and I started October 1st. Washington State Game Department kept me on. They gave me a permanent deal with a deputy game protector. So I worked with them guys and with the timber companies. So I did a lot of bear control work for the timber companies, St. Regis and the Weyerhaeuser, and Jack Aldridge invented the Aldridge snare. See, he got going on that about 1958. Another friend of mine, Mike Thornley, that worked for the state, he was a state beaver trapper. The farmer had a complaint, well, then the beaver trapper would be called, and he'd call and take care of the problem. Well, Mike liked to trap coyotes, and he liked to trap bear, and so it got to be quite a deal with Thornley and I. He lived about 40 miles from where I lived. When I first went to work for the Fish and Wildlife Service, I had all of Western Washington. It was my territory.
Pretty big chunk.
Yeah, it was. And so you got complaints from all over. And your funding came from the chicken growers and the wool growers, so the county commissioners had to know kind of what you were doing. There was a certain amount of politics involved with your funding. So I worked hard and tried to do a good job, and I always got funding each year. And Thornley and I'd go down and spend 2-3 days a week in the summer with him. We'd run about 200 sets, mostly for coyotes. And then between the two of us, I think we had about 25 bear traps. That was always a big thing. I'd be looking in the St. Regis country around the foot of Mount Rainier for bear sign, and Mike would be down in the Doty country and the flatland down there looking for bear sign. Whoever found the first bear track in the spring, boy, it was a big deal. So we used just a regular cubby sets for these bears. We had a lot of fun experiences, and of course Mike was a hound man, so we would get to trapping bears, and of course we always had a bunch of coyote sets out. The bears would rip the bark off of the base of the trees, the dug fir mostly, and eat the cameon, the inner layer of sap. Not all bears did this, but one bear that was doing it, they figured could kill and damage about 2,500 trees a year. And the trees that they would hit would be a nice second-growth stuff up about 60 years of age, and some of that stuff's up 18 inches, 2 foot on the stump. And they'd hit that stuff right around the outside edge growth, where there were nice big trees. The sun got to it a little quicker, and the sap would run a little sooner, and those were the nice trees that they had hit. So the forester would call you, and you'd go out and throw up a set or two. And then, of course, in the spring, when I was bear trapping, the state game department gave me a bunch of tags, and I'd tag deer fawns for them. One day, I was up checking my coyote traps, and I had a few bear sets in the Puyallup River drainage. And I see this big pile of bear manure in the road. I had tagged about 7 or 8 deer fawns in about a mile and a half right in there a month or so before that. I started noticing that I wasn't seeing as many fawns. Well, I got out and checked this pile of bear manure, and I'll be damned if there wasn't a tag. One of my fawns, war was declared. Yeah. Well, I threw in a big super bear set there in that bottom. About 4 days later, I went back and checked it, and I had a big sow in there. She almost ate me up. I had always took a dog in with me and had a little 30 carbine that I used to dispatch my critters with. I got in there and I see that she was gone. She pulled the drag right up by her. So I stepped on a twig and it snapped, and that bear just boom right at me. I shot, knocked her down. She was up and started again. I shot, knocked her down. Shot her one more time to make sure that she stayed down. Then I sat down and had a little shake. And I measured, and she was just 9 feet from me.
Put the fear of God in you.
It sure did. It sure did. With bears, it was kind of fun because some of the places you go down in and make a set, they were just real spooky. The other fear that you had when you were trapping bears, even when you had some coyote sets and there were a lot of bear around, sometimes you'd catch a cub. You'd walk in on a set, and more than once, my dogs saved me on a situation like that. They'd hassle the old sow. So that used to get exciting every now and then. One time, this Mike Thornley and I, we was down in the Weyerhaeuser area below Tenino, Washington. We went into this place and nobody trapped it. And they said, you can trap all the coyotes you want as long as you trap these bears. So there was a check station there. There was an old watchman at the gate. He had a strawberry patch and the beaver were eating up his strawberries. So Mike and I threw in a couple live traps and trapped the beaver and moved them out for him. So old Cody, he thought that we were real good guys. And
I hope you could hear in Sam's voice just how much he loved his outdoor lifestyle. Let's take a break here for a word from our sponsors. Thanks to our sponsors for supporting this program. When the need arises, I hope you will support them in return. Now let's get back to our interview with Sam Snyder. In this next section, Sam tells about many of his own personal hunting and trapping adventures, but also describes some of his work with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
So anyway, when the opening day of fishing season, which was on a Sunday, Weyerhaeuser had a crew truck and they would haul fishermen in. You couldn't drive in, but they'd haul you back in there 20 miles or so and let the guys fish and then pick them up in the evening and bring them out. So Mike and I had a couple of big super bear sets and, of course, a bunch of coyote sets in there. And So it was down on Fall Creek. That's where we threw in the last big bear set, because there's been a bear hanging around there, and it was quite a bit of timber damage. And this Fall Creek had a bunch of big, nice beaver ponds in it, and it was, oh, probably a quarter of a mile off of the road down to the creek. So we drove up to the gate, and old Cody come out, and he said, "Did you guys have a bear trap set down on Fall Creek?" Our first thought was, God, we caught somebody in a trap. The Fish and Wildlife Service gave us white cloth signs that said danger, and you had to have two of those on each set and a pair of clamps within hand reach so you could get out. Mike said, "I'm not sure if we did or not." "Well, I don't know. We were going to, did we set it or not, you know?" Well, finally, old Cody, he said, "You had a hell of a big black bear in that trap down there on Fall Creek," and he said he just about eat a fisherman. Oh, maybe we did have a set down there, and so we got the guy's name and what had happened. The bear went down there 100 yards or so, and this guy was walking down this log, and this bear come right up alongside the log, scared the hell out of him. He had a little 22 Colt with him, and he shot him and finally killed the bear, and then he drugged the bear out, and he was out of work, and so he could use some meat, so he took the bear. So that was fine with us. But anyway, that all turned out good. Then another time, Thornley and I was up in the New Wacom country, and I was in Weyerhaeuser country also. And we were trapping some bear and coyotes up in there. And we'd seen where there was a swarm of bees, and there was some bear sign right around there. So we threw in a super bear set, and we used a beef head for our bear sets. You'd hang that on the wire, tie it good up next to a big stump, and then make a cubby, force the bear where to step and when he come in. And we came by, and there was about a two-year-old, maybe three-year-old bear, a real small bear and real skinny. We had Mike's pickup, and he had a little canopy on it, and we had our hounds and bait and stuff in the back of this pickup. So I told Mike, I said, "Hell, there's no use wasting a shell on that, so I'll just take a club and kill him." So, okay, that's what I did. Took him out of his trap and threw the bear in the back of the truck with the hounds and reset our trap. And down the old logging road we went. We went maybe an eighth of a mile and heard them dogs barking, bellowing back there. I turned around and looked through the window, and I said, "Mike," I said, "stop." I said, "That bear is up in one corner." He said, "He's back there by the tailgate. And here's his house." This damn bear, I hadn't killed him. He'd come back to life. Here he's in there with the damn hound. So this time I get the rifle. And so Mike said, "I'll open the tailgate, turn him loose, and you shoot him." So I bear barreled out of that back of that truck. So I shot the bear. Mike and I talk about that to this day. I had a lot of good experiences down there. I averaged about 200 coyotes a year and around 75, 80 bobcats, and I don't know how many foxes and skunks and raccoons, etc. You know, there's numbers and numbers of those. The best year I had on bears, we started trapping bears usually in the middle of April, and we'd finish up by the 1st of September because hunting season would be open. The best year I had on that was 33. In the 4 years I was with the department down there, I'd taken probably 100 black bears. When I left the department, I'd had two raises, and I was getting $260 a month.
Big money.
Big money, yep. But we were happy, and we had the best fishing in the summer. My kids all got to go. One time I had my kids with me up on the Puyallup River in St. Regis, and we got two bears and four coyotes one day. And when we ate lunch, I always knew where some good beaver ponds were so we could catch some cutthroat. That was the other thing. Kids enjoyed it, but we had a good time doing all those things.
Well, how did you end up moving from Washington? How did you end up in Alaska? Or am I jumping the gun?
No, not really. A guy called me one evening from Cordova. He was a retired captain from Fort Lewis. And I used to go out and do quite a bit of work on the Fort Lewis Reservation on bears and coyotes. Omer Ware was his name, and so he said, "You're just the man I need to come up here." And he said, "I need you to run a lodge for me in McCarthy." And I said, "Well, it sounds good." And so I went and talked to my brother the next day, and I took a couple weeks annual leave, and my wife and I and my brother flew up here in January, I guess it was, of 1960. Northern Pacific Airlines, an old Connie. We left Seattle, we flew to Annette, and then it went to Juneau, and then it stopped in Yakutat, and then Cordova. It took 8 hours to get from Seattle to Cordova. And then they flew us into McCarthy in a 180, and needless to say, my wife was not impressed at all. The snow was knee-deep, you better believe it was. Gee, I got to see all those moose on the way in, but Jesus, now I wanted to float the Copper River. I said, boy, that'd be a beautiful thing to go down. Well, God, you know, had all kinds of these wild things. And I went back and then I just resigned, given about a month. And took all of our life savings, about $600, and we drove an old Greyhound bus to Valdez, had a guy drive for us. And they drove it into Valdez, and then that went over to Cordova for a tour bus, and they used it at the Windsor Hotel. Had these old Jeeps, and we'd go over to Maycrick and pick up the mail in the summertime, usually twice a week a mail plane come in. That got to where it was a lot of fun to drive 15 miles over to Maycrick. Well, I was over there with the kids one day getting the mail, and geez, I drove up toward the Chittatoo a little bit. Man, here's all this wolf sign. God, oh man, what a place to make a set. I had about a half a dozen Victor number 48 that we used for beaver. I had one of those in the Jeep with me and I had some scent. Man, I threw in a big super set. Couldn't wait to get back over the next morning, even though I thought that's kind of soon. It was gone, dragging all this. So I heard this rattling down in the little gully below us, so I went down there and here I had this big gray wolf. Boy, it was really neat. Of course, in the summertime, it was just an easy set to make. So that was my first wolf I caught. Well, next winter, I was 60 and 61. Jack Wilson was flying into McCarthy Love. We knew him real well, and by then, he wanted to know if I'd gun for him. I said, sure, I'd love to do that. And so we went around with the Super Cub and some of the wolf kills, and we started making some sets, and we started catching some wolves, and Jack thought that was great. And then we got into a pack or two, and I shot several wolves, and just had a great time. One thing led to another, and then he wanted to know if I would work assistant guide for him. And
now, where was he from?
He was from Glen Allen. He'd come into McCarthy, and then he was hunting that upper Chitna. In 1961, when Harry Swank got the world's record doll sheep, I was working for Jack, and I was in the next camp down with Jack Birch. He was a registered guide from Cordova. Jack Birch and I had two hunters from Oklahoma City, a father and a son, and we got sheep for them. We was up on what's now called McCall Ridge, and we come back out, and Jack picked us up, and he was all excited. We didn't know that Harry got the news, the world's sheep, and it was pretty exciting.
Well, what did you think of that sheep when you first saw it?
Oh, unbelievable. Just huge. The ones that we got were nice sheep, 38-inch sheep.
Dwarf.
Yeah, they were, you know, compared to what Harry's sheep is.
And had Jack known that that sheep was in there? I mean, had he seen it previously? And
they had seen this sheep for a couple of years and knew it was there. And Jack was always pretty secretive about all these different things, you know, which made sense. And you didn't tell everybody where your favorite spots were to hunt. So it was pretty exciting, and just to been working for the guy not too far from where they got it. And when I was working there for Jack, we were given two hunters, and we stayed with them for usually a month. We would go sheep hunting, and he'd move us from sheep camp to moose and caribou and bear. And so you were gone for a whole month with just two hunters. That was the way Jack worked his operations in those days. So I worked, I guess, two seasons for him.
Was that pretty enjoyable?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was exciting. You know, I mean, it was a great deal. You know,
be out on a hunting trip and get paid for it, huh?
Not only that, and you're guiding in Alaska. Things that you read about in outdoor life and field and stream. When you was a kid, I used to dream about these guides. So I got to do these things. When the first summer I was up here, I got to float that Copper River in August of 1960. Georgie White and her river rats, they were some of the first greenies up here. Everybody told them bear stories when they got into Cordova. In time they got to McCarthy, they thought, well, it might not be a bad idea to have somebody go along. I kind of got into that discussion with them, and she said, I'll let you go, no charge. She said, if you just go along and protect us if there's any bear problems. I said, boy, what a deal. My wife didn't know if that was a big deal or not. There was four men, and the rest of them were eight women on this trip. Howard Knutson flew us in with a 180, dumped all of our gear off. We had three rafts. We started at Jake's Bar on the Chitna, so we spent one night there. So we left there the next morning and spent about 2 days before we got into Chitna. We only had one bear scare. When they pulled in, they all went out in the bushes to do their thing. I said, two or three, you go together. I showed them the fresh grizzly tracks in this little sandbar we pulled off and made a stop. I said, the bear had been here not very long ago. The two of these gals went into the brush. Pretty soon we heard a scream. And this one old gal, she was 60 years old, and she was an attorney from San Francisco. Frida was her name. She come out of their brush just running, pulling up her britches, and this other blonde gal was running like hell and out of there. And here come this grizzly, done a very big bear, nice color to him. Susie broke out into the open on the river bars there. He just stood up on his hind legs. Well, that got everybody's attention real quick, you know. And so they knew that there was bears around, and they were for real. I think it took us 5 days. We were the first people to ever go through the Abercrombie Rapids and make it. There was a bunch of stories written about it. It was another neat experience.
I could listen to Sam all day, but we've reached the end of our allotted time for today. Don't forget to tune in to Alaska Tracks next week when we'll hear more from Sam Snyder.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.